brother, do you think they'll drop the bomb?
This is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Happy to have you along here on Friday afternoons as we roll towards the weekend. On another sticky, steamy summer day. Yeah, it is actually still summer, isn't it, Max?
I believe it is.
I think we have like a week of summer still to go.
The kids are back in school and the pools are closed, but sure, it's summer.
I mean, technically, it's still summer. Mm-hmm. This is the time of the show every week when we turn our attention to the new movies that are out and other showbiz stuff. We are going to review three movies for you today, and I'm just going to tell you ahead of time, one of these movies is going to be on my worst movies of the year list. Should I start with that one, or should we start with something else, Max?
Let's start with one of the worst movies of the year, in the opinion of Mr. Paul Harris. Does it have any relation to the song I just played?
Yes, it does.
Aha!
Yes, the movie is called Mother.
Mm.
Mother with a small M.
And
an exclamation point at the end.
Can I ask a small favor of you, Paul?
Yes.
You and I don't discuss the movies before we go on the air here, whether or not we've seen them together at a screening or one of us hasn't seen the movie. I have not seen this movie yet. Mm-hmm. I was not able mm-hmm. to see the screening. I would very much like to see it. I just don't want giant spoilers. If you could, refrain from some giant spoilers.
Okay.
Or otherwise, I can take off my headphones
and
skedaddle down the road.
This will be really easy for me not to spoil, because when I walked out of this movie, I didn't know what I had seen. I just knew that I hated it.
Fantastic.
The movie's called Mother. It's from Darren Aronofsky, who's the guy who did Black Swan, but also did a movie that you and I liked very much a few years ago called Kill the Messenger with... No, that's not him. That's the other guy
we're talking
about today. What's the other Darren Aronofsky movie?
He did Requiem for a Dream.
That's right.
Pie. The Wrestler and Black Swan.
The Wrestler,
Noah.
Wrestler was the only one of those that I liked. That was with Mickey Rourke and the amazing Marissa Tomei.
I am in a different camp. I've loved every single thing that Aronofsky's done. I think The Fountain might be his masterpiece.
Okay, well,
I love this film.
Maybe you'll like this then. I did not. The plot of Mother starts with Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem as a couple living in a big Victorian house with not much around them except a meadow and some trees. He is a poet with writer's block. She is fixing up the house on her own. There are no workmen, no workwomen there. It's just the two of them. He can't write. She's working on the house. One day there's a knock on the door and Ed Harris stumbles into their lives. And
don't you hate it when Ed Harris just shows up unannounced?
It turns out that he's a big fan of Javier Bardem's poet character. Bardem allows Ed Harris to spend the night, and the next day, Michelle Pfeiffer shows up as Ed Harris's wife, and she moves in, too. And Jennifer Lawrence doesn't understand why her husband is allowing these complete strangers into their personal space, and from there on, she walks around with a puzzled look on her face for the remainder of the movie. Well, I'll change that, because sometimes the look on her face is not a puzzlement. Is that a word?
Yes, puzzlement.
She's not puzzled. She's horrified.
Aha.
The look changes to horror because the couple's two sons show up and there's a fight and somebody ends up dead. And during all of this, Bardem does nothing to stop anything and Jennifer Lawrence screams.
I have theories. Like Bardem's already dead or there is no house or hell is other people.
You asked me not to spoil the movie and now you're coming up with your own spoilers.
I've seen the trailer and it looks phenomenal.
I'm not going to tell you anything about that. I will tell you that from there until the end of the movie, all you get from either of the two leads is apathy from him and terrified panic from her. This is the kind of movie where at one point Jennifer Lawrence goes to the basement and sees blood dripping down the walls of the basement of the house that she lives in and she tells no one. She doesn't run upstairs. Honey, come downstairs here. Is this blood dripping down the walls? She doesn't say anything to anybody. Is this a metaphor for a horror movie? Is it a metaphor for a writer's block? What the hell is it? I don't know. Max, I do not know. And frankly, I don't care. I will say that I sympathize with Jennifer Lawrence's character in this movie because she is apparently trapped in this house with something terrible taking place. Mm. And I was trapped in that movie theater for 2 full hours with a terrible movie unfolding in front of me.
Did you dislike Black Swan?
Correct. I did not like Black Swan.
Really? That was my favorite film that year.
Okay. We're allowed to have different opinions.
I can't wait to see
it. And maybe you'll go see this and you'll like it. But for me, Mother... And I think for a lot of people, by the way, Mother is going to be considered self-indulgent. There's an exclamation point at the end of the title for no reason. This movie is too long. It is unsettling to see such good actors locked into a script that takes them nowhere. I like Jennifer Lawrence. I like Javier Bardem. I like Ed Harris. I like Michelle Pfeiffer. They are in a bad, bad movie here, which I want to warn you, if you ever watch this on video and you're calling it up on Amazon Prime or on Netflix, do not confuse this with Albert Brooks' 1996 movie, also called Mother, which is about him as a grown man moving back in with his mom, who was played by the late Debbie Reynolds. That's not one of Albert Brooks' best. You shouldn't even watch that. But you're better off watching that five times in a row than sitting through 2 hours of this.
Albert Brooks had a great line about this on Twitter. He said, "I can't believe they've remade my movie without my permission. I hope Jennifer Lawrence is as good as Debbie Reynolds."
Yeah.
But, oh, that's
funny. Pretty funny.
Yeah.
I'm not sure remaking his would have been much better than this, but this is terrible. Two. On a scale of 10.
Wow, two. Now, why? Now,
well, you know what? Two with an exclamation point for
okay.
no reason.
A lowercase two with an exclamation point. So, what gives it the two? Is it just the acting? I mean, does it raise it up from a zero?
The plot,
the worst?
The plot is ridiculous. The acting is okay, but at a certain point, they're not acting anymore. Like I said, Javier Bardem just wanders around not doing much of anything, and Jennifer Lawrence is screaming through at least the last 40% of this movie.
Hmm. A big bomb, you think? Box office bomb?
I think this...
People won't
Well, I think that some people may go because Jennifer Lawrence, you know, she's been doing the late night show. She was on Fallon the other night. She was on Seth Meyers last night.
Mm-hmm.
She goes out and publicizes her movies because that's what movie stars have to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think anybody who's a big Jennifer Lawrence fan is going to be severely disappointed in this. And if it does any box office this weekend, the box office will drop off dramatically when word of mouth gets around that this thing sucks.
I imagine she's not just promoting the film out of contractual obligation, but romantic obligation as well, as she has struck up a relationship with Darren Aronofsky.
Oh, really? I did not know that. They're a couple?
That's why I'm here.
Okay, well, maybe that explains something. But... wow. I'll tell you, I've been married for a long, long time. But if I were dating somebody
and they said, "Here's the script,"
who sent me this script, we're done. I'm going all Costanza on you. We're done. I read your script. I'm never dating you again. Whew, big mistake by Jennifer Lawrence. Mother, 2 out of 10.
Wow. Harsh.
Now, what did you see this week?
I saw something called Rebel in the Rye, which is all about J.D. Salinger. Now, I know that he's an iconic American figure. Catcher in the Rye obviously was a watershed for American literature. It was a game changer as far as one of the pillars of the introduction of the notion of the teenager. And, you know,
did you like the book?
I have not, in all honesty, been able to finish the book. In high school and in my early 20s, I knew some people who were diehard Salinger fans who had read Franny and Zoe and Nine Stories, and they loved this man. And they, of course, were enamored with the story of how he'd sequestered himself and nobody'd seen him for 20 years and all this stuff. I mean, that sort of feeds into the mythic qualities of him. But I've tried to read Catcher a couple of times, and I couldn't connect with not only Holden Caulfield, but also the way his style, just the way the book was written.
Yep.
And I put it down a couple times over the years, and I thought, well, the fault here is definitely with me and not this piece of art.
No, the fault is not with you. Catcher in the Rye is one of the most overrated books in American history.
Well, I'm happy to hear somebody else say
it. I'm totally with you. I was forced to read this entire thing in high school. Well, I wasn't forced to read the entire thing. Frankly, I went to the Cliff's Notes.
Oh, sure.
Because I had to write a book report about it in high school.
For the kids out there who don't know, before the internet and Wikipedia, we had Cliff's Notes.
Right. It was a printed version of Wikipedia.
Yes.
So I never read the entire book either. I went to the Cliff's Notes. But that's because I started reading the book and got bored. It was just not interesting. It's not compelling to me in any way.
I've tried a couple times. Now, there's been great albums that people love, and sometimes you put them on and they don't really capture your imagination. And then years later, you can put it on and go, wow, I like this song a lot. So I thought maybe Catcher will one day catch up with me.
No. Here's the best use of Catcher in the Rye in anything since then. the movie Conspiracy Theory with Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts.
Okay.
He's a conspiracy theory guy who has been working for the CIA as a hitman years before that. And as part of the things that were implanted in his brain, for some reason, every time he's in a bookstore and sees a copy of Catcher in the Rye, he has to buy it. And she notices that on the shelf in his apartment, he has like 25 different copies of Catcher in the Rye. That's the only good reason for Catcher in the Rye to exist, as far as I'm concerned.
Maybe that's why it sold so many copies. There was
because there were a lot of nutty people.
Who knows?
Maybe. So this is about J.D. Salinger writing the book?
It is. It's about his early life, all pre his, you know, when he went all hermit. This is written and directed by Danny Strong. Danny Strong was a young actor who started out on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and then he later went on to work on Gilmore Girls, but he had wanted to break in as a writer, and he's actually become a pretty in-demand Hollywood writer. He wrote The Butler with Lee Daniels. He was a co-creator of Empire with Lee Daniels, and he also wrote the last two Hunger Games movies, Mockingjay Part 1 and 2, speaking of Jennifer Lawrence. He wrote Game Change, the Julianne Moore as Sarah Palin movie.
Oh, yeah. That was really good. Speaking of Ed Harris, he played John McCain in that
exactly.
movie.
Exactly. And so he is a pretty in-demand screenwriter, and he wrote this about Salinger, and he decided to make it his directorial debut. And I will say, the movie is really well put together. I think he has a future as a director. He's a really talented young guy. And it's also cast very well. I think that if there is any issue with this movie, it's the person who plays Salinger himself, and we'll talk about that. But it's also the script is just a little too on the nose and a little too Hallmark channel-y. You know, this a movie like this, it's definitely written with the hindsight that this man is a genius, and he's wrote one of the most beloved books of all time. So what you have is you have people constantly telling him, you're never going to be anything as a writer, and why are you writing this book? And I'm not saying that didn't happen to him, mm-hmm. but it pays off to the audience, like, look, hey, audience, you're in on this. You know that he's an, you know, how about you show me some of his process and not just remind me that he's Salinger in big capital letters?
Yeah.
Now, again, I said that the movie is cast very well. You've got a great supporting cast, including Victor Garber and Zoe Dutch, who's finally in a decent movie. Lucy Boynton from Sing Street plays Salinger's wife, and she's phenomenal. And Kevin Spacey, who, after I gave him so many accolades for his gangster character in Baby Driver, he's even better in this as a college prof who is one of Salinger's mentors. He's actually the first person to ever publish him. And he's phenomenal in this role. I think he's sort of low-key doing some of the best work of his career. So if you're a Kevin Spacey fan, definitely watch Rebel.
One of the reasons I respect Kevin Spacey so much is here's a guy who's a leading man.
Yes.
He could be the star of any movie he wanted, any script he wanted to do.
Yep.
I don't know if he's an automatic green light, because I don't know what Jennifer Lawrence is an automatic green light.
Yes.
I don't know that Kevin Spacey still is. But if he wants to make a movie and wants to star in it, he'll get the financing and be able to make that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But he takes supporting roles in other people's movies and does brilliant work.
And he is brilliant in this. He's the main reason to recommend this movie. Now, unfortunately, the young actor that they've cast as J.D. Salinger, who's in almost every scene, is Nicholas Holt. Nicholas Holt was the young boy in About a Boy with Hugh Grant. He also went on to be Beast in the X-Men superhero films, and he was also in Mad Max Fury Road. I've always been sort of indifferent towards Nicholas Holt. I mean, he's been fine, but he's never really had a leading role until now, and quite frankly, he can't pull it off. There's not a lot going on behind his expressions. You know, they always say that acting is in the eyes, and he just sort of has dead eyes. So he's trying to sell Salinger, and I don't think he does it well at all. Hmm. Maybe
Salinger had dead eyes, and he's doing them perfectly.
Perhaps. But I was reminded of Milos Forman's Amadeus, which was released, I think, 1984. And this was a movie, much like the Hamilton musical now, has captured the imagination of younger people who are interested in American history now. In all the high schools back when Amadeus came out, everybody suddenly cared about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
Yeah.
Because Holst made him approachable and understandable, and that's a genius work of art.
People also discovered Salieri for the first time.
Absolutely.
Because of Beth Marie Abraham.
Who won an Oscar for that. And I was hoping that Rebel in the Rye, which is the name of this movie, would do the same thing. It would win me over. It would tell me why I should be invested in this man and his work. And it doesn't do that.
Mm.
I think it's definitely preaching to the choir. If you love Salinger anyway, then maybe you'll like this portrait about his struggles with getting published. Now, as you know from real life, once he published the book and it was a huge success, for a variety of reasons, one, the pressure of making a follow-up book, but also I think some PTSD from the war, he decides to buy a property in the middle of nowhere and he stays there for the rest of his life. He continues writing, but he never published again while he was alive. The movie ends right there. Like, okay, bye, see you guys later. And it just says, and then Salinger was never heard from again. To me, not being a fan of his work, that's the more interesting part of his life. Mm. And you know that fans visited him. I think he had a couple of relationships with the fans as well.
Wasn't the James Earl Jones character in Field of Dreams, Terrence Mann, based on J.D. Salinger? Because he had written this great book and he could never equal it again. Mm-hmm. And so he had gone away.
Well, yes.
Same kind of thing, right?
I do think that Salinger maybe was a little more, I think it's some more mental and psychological problems.
And his voice wasn't as good.
True. I mean, you know, you don't hear Salinger saying, this is CNN. So I can't recommend Rebel in the Rye unless you are a giant fan of Catcher in the Rye. Then you might like this movie. I wish they would have cast somebody else as Salinger. And I wish the film wouldn't have been so easy and so on the nose of letting the audience know, oh, this guy's a genius. I would have liked to have seen some more struggle and maybe a reason for me as a non-fan to care. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about how you haven't seen Straight Outta Compton and you haven't watched, you know, like Patty Cakes or 8 Mile because you don't like hip hop. And I said, well, if his story is well told, the hip hop becomes secondary. Rebel in the Rye never lets his story be first. It's always about what a genius he was and how great the work was. And I think that's maybe a mistake.
Okay, so what do you give it on a scale of 10?
I'm going to give this right in the middle a 5. And the reason why is because I thought it was an average film at best, except for Kevin Spacey, who really is phenomenal.
All right, more showbiz stuff to come here on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris helping you roll towards your weekend. Max is here in the studio with me, so is Tim. And we're doing our showbiz segment for the week. We've already reviewed 2 movies. Mother with Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem, which I am going to have on my worst movies of the year list. I give it a 2 out of 10. And Rebel in the Rye, which Max said is the definition of an average movie. So he gave it a 5 out of 10. Now, the third movie that is opening today in the St. Louis area is called American Assassin. Do not confuse this with American Made. That's a Tom Cruise movie that's coming out in a couple of weeks. This is a movie that is flying kind of under the radar, and I'll tell you a little bit about it because I went to see it last night. In this movie, Mitch Rapp, that's the character's name, has just proposed to his beautiful girlfriend on the beach in Ibiza, Spain. And he goes to the bar to get a couple of drinks to toast their engagement, and while he's doing that, all hell breaks loose. Some gunmen appear out of nowhere, and they start shooting everybody in sight, including the girlfriend. She's dead. Somehow, he survives. And the next time we see him, we flash forward in the movie, Mitch is in training. It's clear that he is working to get back at the Iranians who pulled off his terrorist attack on the beach that turned his life upside down. Meanwhile, he's attracted the attention of the CIA, which is monitoring his communications with the jihadists, and pretty soon they recruit him to join an elite fighting force called Orion, which is run by a tough guy named Stan Hurley, who is played by Michael Keaton. Now, right there, I hope I got your attention with the name Michael Keaton, because anytime Michael Keaton is on screen in any movie, I'm drawn to that performance. He is a magnetic personality, but I like him best when he's playing a rogue character. This time, he's not the rogue character. He's the boss, and Mitch is the guy who doesn't like following orders. So, you know, they're going to go off on a mission, but they're going to butt heads along the way before they work together to save the world. That's just the formula. You've seen this now, in other movies.
Do they want to save the world, or does he just want revenge? Like, the world saving could be fine, save the world, but I want revenge because of what happened.
All of those things come into play in this movie. Now, the extremely talented assassin slash fighter slash gunman, we've seen that in plenty of movies, especially if he's a rogue character. Think of John McClane in Die Hard. He's going to do it his way. Of course, he's the only one in the original, but he's going to do it his way. Jack Reacher, the Tom Cruise character in his movie. Jason Bourne, the guy who is out on his own and has to solve whatever the problem is by himself. It's the kind of guy who can also withstand a brutal fist fight, because this is the movies, and doesn't matter how many guns there are, you got to have brutal fist fights. Even a couple of weeks ago, we saw a woman doing that. I'm blanking on her name.
Comic Blonde.
Yes,
Charlize Theron.
Blonde. Thank you very much. She plays the kind of woman who can withstand a brutal fist fight. In this, you got that guy. You know, it's the kind of character who will shoot you dead with the last bullet in his gun, even though he's had to miss. You've had to miss him 324 times. He's got one bullet left. He's going to get you.
I'm just happy he took to this training, because after the horrible, tragic thing happens, he could have been really bad at it. He could have tried to, like, become an assassin, and they're like, no, you fail.
That's true. He's the kind of character who always knows exactly where the bad guy is at any time, and where the bad guy doesn't kill the good guy because he wants him to see the havoc he's about to wreak on whatever. Now, you've seen what I just described. You've seen that in dozens of movies. And you're not going to be surprised by this, even by the Tom Clancy ripoff of an ending,
which
I'm not going to spoil for you. That said, Dylan O'Brien, who's the actor who plays Mitch, is very good in this role. And I think he's going to be a franchise player, because Mitch Rapp is the star of 16 novels.
Really?
This is the first one, American Assassin.
Okay, so sort of like they wanted a franchise for Charlize with Atomic Blonde. Keanu Reeves has a new one with John Wick.
Yep.
They want this to be a new franchise.
Correct.
Didn't realize it.
Of course, a lot of people said the same thing about Taylor Kitsch 5 years ago when he graduated from TV star on Friday Night Lights to movie star in John Carter. That didn't quite work out for him. And ironically, Taylor Kitsch is in this movie as one of the bad guys.
Huh.
The cast also includes Sanaa Lathan, who I've seen in plenty of movies, and she's always very, very good. She's the CIA authority figure who has to try to reel in Mitch and Stan, but also give him enough rope to get the job done, because turns out they're both rogues.
Everybody's a rogue.
Now, I mistakenly mentioned in the last review, Kill the Messenger, the Jeremy Renner movie, which we referenced last week, in which he plays a real-life journalist named Gary Webb, who uncovered the CIA's role in importing cocaine into American ghettos in the 1990s. That movie was well-directed by a guy named Michael Cuesta, who I haven't heard of anything about since.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Cuesta directed this movie.
What a very different film.
Yes. That's not an action movie, although it's called Kill the Messenger. This is an action movie called American Assassin, and he does a good job. He gets the action sequences right, he doesn't telegraph what's coming next, and most of all, he lets Michael Keaton be Michael Keaton.
Well, when you've hired him, you might as well just let him go.
Michael Keaton, you might describe as a rogue actor.
Sure.
But you give him enough rope to do what he has to do on screen, and he comes through with just the right performance.
So what I'm hearing is there's nothing really spectacular about this plot.
Right.
Or because you've seen it before.
Right.
But for what it is, it's well done.
Yes. And if you go in knowing that, now remember you and I had a discussion about The Hitman's Bodyguard a few weeks ago.
Yep.
You went in with your expectations too high and you were disappointed.
And you love that movie.
I didn't love it. But I went in with low expectations and it exceeded them. Mm-hmm. So I had a good time while you didn't. This is the same kind of thing. Don't go in here expecting this to be one of the greatest dramatic movies of all time. Go in knowing that you're going to see a movie called American Assassin. That's what you're going to get. And this is going to be the start. I'm sure this is going to do some box office.
Huh.
It's not going to be a big box office movie, but it doesn't really have
competition. I mean, it's against Rebel in the Rye, and it's against Mother.
Yes.
So I think at the multiplex, a lot of people might go see something called American Assassin.
It's the one of the three that I would recommend. I give it a 6.5 out of 10.
Huh.
We'll break and come back with more, including Jerry Seinfeld's upcoming Netflix special. And remember when Hollywood was blaming Rotten Tomatoes for their rotten summer? Well, we have some data on that to share with you next on the Big 550 KTRS. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Thanks for following me on Twitter at Paul Harris Show. And for joining me here on Friday afternoons to help you roll towards the weekend. We'll have the Harris Challenge in about a half hour or so. Max is here with me, and we're talking about movies. We've already reviewed three so far today. Mother with Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem gets a 2 on a scale of 10. Rebel in the Rye gets a 5 on a scale of 10. And American Assassin which you may not have heard of, but it's opening this weekend in a lot of theaters, a 6.5 out of 10. So that's our recommendation for the weekend. Max, you may remember a few weeks ago, you and I were talking about Hollywood complaining about this terrible summer that they've had, where they didn't really have as many blockbusters as they wanted to. Wonder Woman made a lot of money.
Yes.
What else was a big moneymaker this summer?
Well, it doesn't count for the summer, but It, which is in theaters now, it broke records for a horror film. It was the biggest opening for a horror film of all time. And this weekend, it's projected to make another $50 million based on pre-sales. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense because the three movies we just talked about are all smaller movies.
Right.
So I don't think anybody's going to dethrone that. As far as the rest of the year, I mean, Wonder Woman was the main storyline. I'm trying to think of what else came out this year. Spider-Man did pretty well. It's the umpteenth Spider-Man film that we've had, but that one did all right because mm-hmm. The Marvel movies have a built-in audience.
But a lot of the other ones that they were hoping would be franchise starters or big box office
those
ones,
did not
like
work.
King Arthur. And the...
Yeah, King Arthur failed, and The Mummy failed. That's out on Blu-ray and DVD this week. That was supposed to launch the Dark Universe. That didn't happen. I guess Guardians of the Galaxy did pretty well for Marvel.
Part 2. Yeah. So the Hollywood had to find somebody to blame, and it can't be the fact that the Hollywood executives chose bad movies
right.
and wasted millions, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not their fault.
No.
There's got to be an external reason. And they blamed it on the website Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes, it's critics' fault.
Yes, because the critics are giving these movies such low ratings, and everybody can see what the Rotten Tomato number is when they go to Fandango or IMDb. Well, IMDb has its own, but there are other movie sites that you go to and you take a look, and everything's down to a number. Now, you may remember Hollywood hated when Siskel and Ebert first started out 20 mm-hmm. plus years ago, because all they did was thumbs up or thumbs down. And in the movie reviews, you would see Siskel and Ebert say, 2 thumbs up.
Yeah, in ad campaigns for the movies, you open up the newspaper, you would see 2 thumbs
yeah.
up.
So they, yeah. they claimed they hated that, but because it reduced the movie to just, you know, a binary system. And that's what movies are. Well, yeah, it is. Because when you ask your friends, did you like this movie, they're going to tell you yes or no. And that's what that was. And that's what Rotten Tomatoes is.
You know, I have much less of a problem with the Siskel and Ebert thumbs up, thumbs down, because Netflix is also started doing that now instead of a star rating
mm-hmm.
because 2 stars, what does that mean? 4 stars, it's just a simple yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
And again, at a glance, I'm fine with that. I think a lot of Siskel and Ebert fans love that television show where they did more than just thumbs up, thumbs down.
Yes.
They would actually talk about the movies like you and I have done this hour. And of course, Ebert won the Pulitzer for film criticism, so he was an incredible writer.
Right.
I have had my issues with Rotten Tomatoes as well. I don't like the idea that, well, this movie gets 67. What does it even mean? I do like longer form criticisms, but it's probably because I myself am a film critic.
Yeah, but I think you can attach a number to it at the end just as a general guide for people. I don't have a problem with that.
Which we've also done on this show.
Yes, we do. A gentleman by the name of Eve Berquist, who manages the Data and Analytics Project at USC's Entertainment Technology Center, heard about Hollywood whining about low Rotten Tomatoes scores are killing our box office. So he went back and checked box office return data through a website called Box Office Mojo, which mm-hmm. anybody can go to and see how movies are doing.
Yep.
He went through the 150 movies released thus far this year that grossed more than $1 million. Then he plugged in the Rotten Tomatoes scores and looked at a correlation between the scores and the financial performance. The result? Nope. Hollywood, you're wrong. The math is pretty overwhelming. There is no positive or negative correlation between what Rotten Tomatoes reviewers say and what the box office turns out to be.
Interesting.
In other words, when a movie sucks, it's your fault, Hollywood. You made a bad movie. Stop blaming the critics or the reviewers who are actually human beings who go to these things. Because there are 2 Rotten Tomatoes scores. One is the critics, which is before a movie comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And then after it comes out, people can go on there and give their own rating to that.
Yep.
And that's how sometimes movies get big ratings.
And sometimes they're very different. I mean, when Batman vs. Superman came out, the critics really didn't like it. And the audience score on that's much higher.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of big blockbuster movies, there's yet another director change for a Star Wars movie. Last week, you told us about this guy, Colin Trevorrow,
yes.
who lost the job directing an upcoming movie. Was that going to be Star Wars 9?
That was going to be Star Wars 9, and he's been replaced with J.J. Abrams, who, of course, directed The Force Awakens. This is an interesting and very safe choice by Kathleen Kennedy, who now holds the keys to Lucasfilm. She'd worked with George Lucas for many, many years, and he personally chose her to shepherd his creation through the next couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Disney is having some interesting growing pains though with Star Wars and managing Star Wars like they've managed their Marvel property as well. In the Marvel movies, we've realized that the directors can be fired at a moment's notice. So can the actors. So can the writers. We've had major changes in those movies because it's been a producer-driven system of the overall story has to make sense. We are connecting 14 movies. And so the director's vision, like a movie like Mother, which could only be made by one director, that's not really at play with these big franchise movies, for better or for worse. Star Wars was always the product of George Lucas. Even though he'd farmed it out to a couple of different directors, he was always on set. He very much controlled his baby.
Yep.
Well, he sold the property for $4 billion, most of which he all gave to different charities, which, God love him, that's incredible. And Kathleen Kennedy, with Disney, has now taken it over. J.J. Abrams did the first non-Lucas Star Wars movie called Force Awakens, which was a ginormous hit, and he had the very nerve-wracking chore to introduce new characters to an audience and hopefully have those characters connect. So you've got Luke Skywalker and Princess Leia and Han Solo, but you also had Rey and Finn and Poe. You had to make sure that people cared about those characters, and I think he did a good job with a very safe film that's really just a retread of the first Star Wars film.
Right.
But it made all the money in the world.
Yeah.
Then they had Gareth Edwards, who was actually a replacement director for Rogue One. Josh Trank was fired from that movie, and Gareth Edwards had his movie completely re-edited, a lot of new scenes reshot by the powers that be at Lucasfilm to make Rogue One fit with their vision for Disney. Now that episode 8 is in post-production now and is directed by Rian Johnson, who's done science fiction movies like Looper, the next film was supposed to be helmed by Colin Trevorrow, who did Book of Henry, which is one of the biggest flops this year. And after this giant flop, he started saying all these things about episode 9 that he was going to do, and I think they slowly backed away and said, no, you're not going to do this movie. As a matter of fact, we're going to have J.J. Abrams come back in and complete this trilogy. The reason why I call it a safe choice is because we're not going to see bold, crazy characters or giant twists in this movie, because Disney is worried about offending the Star Wars base. They want to make very, very safe movies. Will it be a good movie? Probably, and I think JJ is a really good choice. What is the most interesting part of this for me is I don't know what Disney does with the Star Wars property after that. We will have then had three saga movies, episodes 7, 8, and 9, and three standalone movies by that time. Rogue One, the Han Solo movie, which is filming now, which also had directors fired from that production, and an Obi-Wan movie. At that point, you've got six movies. In just a couple of years, the Disney will have
produced. I know what's coming after that. Origin story, the Ewoks.
Well, it could be. Disney had said, we want a Star Wars movie in theaters every year. I worry, with all of these firings and all of the behind-the-scenes machinations, maybe they back off. Maybe they just wait, instead of trying to print money, maybe just take a breath for a couple of years and wait till a good story comes your way.
You're saying an idea and a story are more important than the economics?
No.
That's crazy talk.
It won't happen.
I know.
But I think that's what we're seeing behind the scenes with these directors being removed and actors and writers being removed, is that the story is just not as important as that almighty dollar.
All right, let me quickly mention two Netflix stand-up specials you want to be aware of. If you're a Marc Maron fan, he has a new one that's called Too Real, which started streaming this past Tuesday and will be on the service forever, like all the, because it's a Netflix original. Very funny. I happen to be a Maron fan. I enjoy his stuff. Next Tuesday, they are going to start streaming the new Jerry Seinfeld special, which is called Jerry Before Seinfeld, in which he goes back to the comic strip in New York, which is the comedy club he started out in and which launched his career. And he goes back and does never before seen material, tells some old jokes, and talks about the history of what his life was like before the TV show.
It's a great title.
Yep. Jerry Before Seinfeld.
It's a great title.
Going to start streaming next Tuesday, but you can add it to your list today if you're a Netflix subscriber. And that's our showbiz stuff for this week on the Big 550 KTRS.